I've got 8 o'clock now on my clock, so we can start this morning's talk. This is the third day, but 2.5 days maybe, of the meditation retreat. And it's usually the first two talks which I give. That's the one on the evening of the Friday and on Saturday morning. I usually just give very general talks, and I do that for a reason, because it's important that people can settle in to the retreat center. They get to know everything here, they feel safe, they get to understand and what they can do, what they can't do. And when they have that beginning part of their practice, they start to get some quietness, some peace. It is true that some people say, oh, can't we have something in the afternoons? It's a long afternoon after lunch until the evening talk. But of course, you know, we do have the other duties of giving interviews, and you can't do two things at the same time. But also, I hope that I can encourage each one of you to be able to meditate on your own with no real schedule. So you can sit here for 5 minutes or 2 hours, whichever works out. You can do the walking meditation, come back and sit. You've got nothing to interrupt the afternoon. And if you do feel tired, you can always go back to your room and have a rest any time. And I emphasize this, that very often in my life as a monk, sometimes you had a good sleep at night. And then in the morning, you know, you start meditating and something feels, the body feels a bit sort of uneasy. And what I do is I actually ask my body, ask my mind. I say, body, what do you want to do? Mind, what do you want to do? That's like being aware, mindful of just, you know, your feelings in the body and the feelings in the mind. And when you get to know your own body and mind very well, people say, of course I know my body, but you don't. It's not really deep enough. When you get to know your body and get to know your mind very, very well, you get really accurate answers. And sometimes surprising, not what I expect. Sometimes in those mornings, I say that I have a free morning, or kind of have a free morning, an hour or two, and then I just go to my cave and ask my body, what do you want? I said, I really want to sleep. Why? You've had a good night's sleep. But I never argue. And I know it's the right thing to do, because when I do that, I lay down, and basically I go to sleep almost immediately, within a minute of hitting the pillow, you're out. And then 45 minutes afterwards, or an hour, you wake up and you feel just so good. And oftentimes I kind of think, I'm not sure, but there was something happening in my body, like a COVID coming, or a flu coming, or some disease coming. And my body was saying, look, Ajahn Brahm, you get out of the way, lay down, and the body will look after that sickness. And that's why I haven't had any sicknesses for years. And the same with my mind. Sometimes I ask my mind, what do you want to do? And it's late at night, and I think, oh, I should go to sleep now. My mind said, no, just cross your legs, let's do some meditation together. And then you get some amazing meditations when you shouldn't get any good meditation. You should be really wiped out and tired. But I trust my body and my mind. It knows better than I do what it needs. So that's something which I would always encourage you. In the first few days, hopefully you do take some rest. And then you get settled into this place. And then basically you don't need any rest. Or not much rest. And you'll be amazed that when you start meditating, how your requirements for sleep in the evening go way down. You're more alive, more alert. And it's obvious why. When you're at work, or when you're out there planning this, doing that, answering to a boss, doing all sorts of stuff, of course that will tire your brain out. Answering emails, writing reports. But here, you've got nothing to do. So your brain should be able to take a break and not get so tired that you need to take more sleep. You're relaxing, you're resting. And because of that, you need less sleep. But that has to come naturally. not what you think you should be doing, but just how you feel your body, what your body needs. Same with food. Sometimes you want to eat a lot, sometimes you want to eat a little. It's very difficult with me, I must admit, because sometimes people bring me special food and they say, Ajahn Brahm, I made this for you specially, please eat it. And I feel sort of a little bit guilty if I don't eat it. Could you give it to me? Say, they brought this over special for you, pancakes, Ajahn Brahm. Can you please eat some pancakes? So I did eat a couple, Nolia. I wouldn't have eaten them, I must admit, if I didn't hear that you sent them over for me. So this is sometimes, you know, you're kind, but also the most important person to be kind to is your own body and your own mind. And when you start to do that, you start to realize that about this time in the retreat, I hope, if not today, but tomorrow, you're into the retreat. Your brain is not sort of thinking about what you're going to do afterwards or what you did before. It knows the duties you have to do, the chores you have to do. It knows the way around this place. So you feel comfortable here, you feel safe here. And that's when, often I say, the meditation can really start. And because it's going to really start, that's why I give this talk. I give the same talk every range, every retreat I give these days, because it's one of the most useful of the explanations of deep meditation. It's useful because it emphasizes two points. One, you can do it. There's no big obstacle in front of you. Each one of you here has the means to do this. And number two, it just shows you why we always call these meditations an automatic process. It's not what you do, but it's actually what happens when you're not doing anything. And why that happens. And it also emphasizes the point that, you know, yes, we have Theravada meditation, but there's many other types of meditation. And you can understand why we always share these different stories of meditation. Maybe we say we're doing something different in each tradition, each religion when they meditate. But you can see the heart of it from this story. And that is the story, I did flag it the very first talk on Friday evening, the story of Om Mani Padme Hum. And of course, you know, when I was a young Buddhist, that was, what was it, 55 years ago, I would go to any talk by any person simply because we didn't have much choice. It's very hard to find a spiritual teacher anywhere. And I also remember on the TV, the only TV program which was remotely Buddhist was that, I think it was David Carradine, Kung Fu, Little Grasshopper. And when I was saying, oh, there's a Buddhist TV series on the TV, I was a school teacher at this time, and the school teacher said, that's Buddhism, why is it so violent? There's fights every episode. And they had a point. But that was the closest you could get. But nevertheless, I go to all sorts of different teachings. And of course, that was a very popular one, the Om Mani Padme Hum. But of course, it's only much later in your life as a monk you understand what it meant and what a beautiful teaching of meditation that was. The reason it's a beautiful teaching, it uses the old simile of a lotus. And the first time I saw a lotus, I thought, what's the big deal about this lotus? It's just like a closed bud. And you go close to it, it's got no fragrance. You look at the outermost sheath, I don't know if you can even call it a petal, and it's like corrugated. And it's not beautiful at all. There's no color to it, it's not beautiful, it's not fragrant, it's just this closed bud. And then, of course, how does that lotus open? And the most important thing is to know, you've seen lotuses open, there's a little lotus flower on there, kind of open, it's got so many petals. And it opens up gradually. When one petal opens, that allows the petals inside to be exposed, to see them, to smell them, admire them, and then that opens up. How does it open up? You can't pull it aside, pull it apart. You wait for some natural process called the morning. The sun comes up, and it's the warmth and the light of the sun opens up that lotus. And of course, the warmth and light of the sun That, what does that mean in this metaphor? And it should be obvious to you. The light means the awareness, the mindfulness, and the warmth is the kindness. And I have emphasized this, you know, just basically all my life as a teaching monk, that both are necessary. You can't have one without the other. And the two, when they work together, are powerful enough to open up that lotus. The kindness and the awareness working together. And just, you know, for ease of remembrance, I call that kindfulness. I've written books with the title Kindfulness, Kindfulness Training. And when you have the mindfulness and the kindness, it's amazing what works. These things happen naturally. I did make that point when I answered the question about sometimes it's hard to let go of the past and the future. Sometimes it's hard to stay in the present moment. Why? You can't do this through willpower. So I'm going to be in the present moment. We can have a competition. Who can be in the present moment longest? Okay? Start. We can't do competitions because competitions assume willpower. And it's the guys or the girls who have the strongest of willpowers. They're the ones who win. So this is not sort of competition. It's not coming from a self who can be better than other people's selves. It works in a totally different way, this path of meditation, spirituality behind it. How it works is you get out of the way. You don't do anything. Your ego, your sense of self, can just be put aside for a while. And instead, you have this awareness. Does awareness come from a self, from an ego? Can you actually say, I am going to be aware? If you do, then sometimes think, oh, I failed, I wasn't aware, oh my goodness, what should I do now? It just complicates it. Awareness is just like being able to see things. You open your eyes and you can see things. As I say, you keep it still so you can see things very clearly. That awareness is a natural phenomenon of the mind. And the more that you disappear and stop doing things, the more you stop, disturbing awareness, the better it becomes. That's why that seminar I also gave already about Emperor's Three Questions meditation. Now, most important time, whatever's in front of you, the most important thing. Once you see that, it's obvious. How can anybody do anything else? And I get sort of quite frustrated sometimes in interviews when I hear people say, you know, well, I get beautiful nimitta, now what should I do? Oh my goodness, nothing, enjoy it. It took a long time for you to get a nimitta. Just stay there, don't disturb it. But if I don't do anything, then I'm not making any progress. And this little simile of the thousand-petaled lotus, Om Mani Padme Hum, which actually means like worship to the jewel in the heart of the lotus, that simile just explains. When you don't do anything, that is when the meditation progresses. Actually, even the word progress is not quite a good word. It never goes on to the next step. It always goes in to the next level. Here you are with whatever level you're in now. Say you're in a nimitta, beautiful nimitta. Now what do you do? If you do something, you'll disturb it. If you just stay there, just enjoy it. Be aware and be kind to what you're experiencing, which is quite natural. Then you find you go inside. You get drawn inside. It's a natural process. You don't have to do anything. The only thing you can do is disturb it and waste a lot of time. So, the Om Mani Padme Hum, the worship to the jewel in the heart of the lotus. Mani is the jewel, Padme is like inside the lotus, locative case. When you actually go inside that lotus, one thing you do notice is that the more you go into the lotus, the way you go to the innermost leaves, or petals rather, they are the most beautiful, the most fragrant. and also the most thin and profound. And the next most more beautiful layer in that lotus is right inside the one which is you can see right now. This is what happens with the meditation. So you start meditating. You're sitting here and you're sleepy, or you're thinking, oh, what are we going to have for lunch today? Or what am I going to do about this problem when I get back later on? What am I going to do about this or that or whatever? So you've got all these kind of thoughts and disturbances. That is like the outermost petals of the lotus. Rough, sometimes dirty, because the outermost sheath of the lotus has to take the dirt and the wind and the rain and pollution or whatever is there. That's why it's there, it's to protect the innermost petals. So this is where you start. What did you do for the very beginning? Just be aware and be kind, to care. And that's what I do. That's what I hope you do. Very first thing when you sit down, what are you aware of? It's usually the body. It could be the temperature, it's too cold or too hot. And please excuse me, we can't get the perfect temperature on the air conditioner for everybody. Some of you are cold, and sometimes I look at you and just, how many jackets and beanies have you got on? And I'm warm. If I could control the aircon, I'd turn it down a few degrees until it's much more fresh and cool. The reason was I was born in UK. I grew up in UK. And so we're used to cold weather. I wasn't born in Singapore. And so often I say this, and it's still the case. Sometimes I give a talk and it's really warm and hot, and then people come into the room wearing jackets and they ask for an extra blanket to put around them. I can't believe it. Each one of us has different tendencies. And it's because of that, you know, I thought, I don't know if I said this similarly already, about look at the meditation cushions we have. They've been using these for hundreds of years, Japanese zafus. Come on, there's so many people meditate these days. Can't we do something better than these? Can't we have high-tech meditation cushions? And of course, when I started thinking about that, you can imagine your high-tech meditation cushion. How would it work? It'd be like a round ball like that, and then you'd have little controls. If it was too low on your backside, you'd press a button and it would rise up. If it was too high, another button, it would go down. If you need the knees a bit sore, you can have another button and it does a massage. They have that. I've seen those on these aircraft seats. You know, one button and you get a massage on the back. Another button and this part comes out so you can stretch your legs. I mean, that's only the start. And then you can have, if you're afraid of sloth and torpor, if you go too far forward, you have a tiny electric shock. So you can adjust the power of the electric shock, so it's not too disturbing. And then too hot, too cold, what can you do? You have another button, and of course the temperature of the cushion can go down to cool you, or you can actually have this cold air coming up around you. You know, just like on the... Have you seen those like Japanese toilets? You press a button and the water comes out right, exactly in the right place. I don't know how they do that. And you've got the controls, hot or cold or in the middle. And of course, I'm a monk. I don't get much playtime or excitement. So when they'd sent me on this conference, I had one of those in my room. Of course, I did what anybody would do, just press all the buttons and see what happens. And make a big mess in the toilet room. It's good fun. I've never seen anything like that before. But anyway, so you have all these different... You can get your own air conditioning. And the other thing which I would always have if I designed my own high-tech meditation cushion, another one if you really have sloth and torpor. You can actually press another button. Do you want a latte or a cappuccino or a flat white or whatever? How strong... So you can have your own cup of coffee and just drink it there. So you overcome sloth and torpor. I'm sure you could add a few more things on your high-tech meditation cushions. But anyway, that is just obviously not the path, but it's good fun. And I really can't know why people in some of these places like, you know, California haven't done anything like that yet. They listen to my talks, and I've suggested it many times. I'm sure someone in Stanford could actually to make... Look, you know, I've sat in the meditation rooms of Google headquarters over in Mountain View, and also in this big company, number one Hackett Drive in Mountain View. You know which company lives in number one Hackett Drive? That was Facebook. Because they have a big campus, it's their own road, so they gave it the name, Hackett Drive. Hack it, you know, the hackers. Anyway, they all have their own meditation rooms. So you think that they could have some better meditation cushions in there, some high-tech ones, they make a fortune. I'm sure they would sell very well. Anyway, let's go back to the Thousand Petal Lotus. You can see just how you can fantasize, and you can spend the whole meditation working out the best meditation cushion and give up your own peace and quiet now, because that's not really the way, trying to get perfection. Instead, we have kindfulness. So you're aware of your body and you're kind to it. And honestly, you wouldn't believe just how powerful that can be. Your body knows how to heal itself, at least mine does. You just need to give it a chance. Stop interfering with it. Be aware and be kind, because when it's kind to your body, what happens is it relaxes, it feels at ease. And things which were squashed open out, things which were tense ease off. And it's something I maybe spend too much time talking about, but I do that because there's too many people who are sick and ill at ease. And because I know that works, I've done it myself so many times. You know, healing stuff which should not be healable or which should have been sick for much more long time, but you can just basically heal yourself. You can feel it happening and teach it to others, and it helps them as well. So this is where we, you know, we have our body, we know it, aware of it, we don't do anything, we just know it, and then we're kind to it. And any of you who have heard those guided meditations I usually do every Friday night at Nolamara Center, that's how I teach it, just sweeping up your body little by little, and you have maybe a pain in your knee or something because you've been sitting meditation too long. Actually, I don't like the word too long, but you know, without sort of enough care, and you feel that part of your knee, and you just give it so much loving kindness. And of course, also, what is loving kindness? Do you know what it is? We know how to say it, pronounce it, chant it. But when actually you have that loving kindness, the real thing, you can put it on sort of a pain in the knee and everything gets really smooth and open, and it is the pain releases and you get so much less. It also helps you understand what these words really mean, loving kindness. You've all heard sometimes that there's, well, if you've ever been sick in hospital, one of the best therapies is a very kind nurse, someone who just comes to your bedside and just very sweetly asks, how are you? And they really mean it. They don't do anything, but just the fact that they care for you has enormous power. And that's what you do to yourself. You just do it to your knee or other part of the body which is aching and give it really good loving kindness. It heals, and the pain disappears. There's that story, I think I already said it the first night, of the anger-eating monster. Did I? No. Oh, God. Well, I'm just going to say it in brief. I'll say it in full later on. A monster in the Empress's palace all the soldiers, stupid soldiers, say, get out of here, get out their swords and their guns and threaten the monster. Every unkind word, unkind deed, unkind thought, the monster gets bigger and more aggressive, more of a problem. Empress comes in. The reason she's empress is because she's a smart one. And she says to this monster, welcome, monster. Thank you so much for coming. Has anyone got you a cup of tea yet? Or do you prefer coffee? Do you want some biscuits with that? Or maybe a muffin? What would you like to eat? And it was genuine. And because it was genuine, those words of kindness, acts of kindness, thoughts of kindness, the monster just grew less angry, less oppressive, less dangerous. And so the soldiers and people in the palace, they got to see this. They learnt pretty quickly. So they all decided, some soldiers decided to give the monster a foot massage. It's a first. Have you ever had foot massage, reflexology? It's the first time a monster ever had foot massage in its life. Oh, it loved it. Oh, just a little bit over there. Oh, that was really nice, thank you. And some gave. Seen the size of monsters' heads? Those monsters must have a lot of shoulder pain with a big head like that to hold on top. And so a few of the other soldiers gave him a shoulder massage. Wow. And they were so kind to the monster that the monster kept on shrinking and shrinking and shrinking until it was back to the size of some of the other soldiers. They rang out for a pizza because they have monster pizzas, apparently. That's true, somebody told me that. I never had one myself, but apparently you can order a monster pizza. So they got a monster pizza for the monster. But before it came, they were so kind and so loving. The monster got so small that it vanished completely away. And that's based on a Buddha story with lots of additions. But he called it an anger-eating monster. And there's lots of those in your body. Give it anger, the pain gets worse. Fear is a part of anger. And so when we give it kindness instead, it's amazing, your body just gets really at peace and healthy. And because it's at peace, there's nothing, no business to do there. So that's what we start with. We just give kindfulness to our body. And because it settles all the business, there's nothing to be done there anymore. And it's like this outermost petal, your body, opens up and reveals what's inside. Now you go into the petals, the real petals of the lotus, the mind petals. And the first one you usually see is, again, time. When you look at your mind, one of the things which you are prisoner of is the past and the future. They dominate you. It's hard to get out of those two jails. Carrying the burden of your past and other people's past as well, and the fear of the future. And all one needs, the trick to be able to let go of those, is kindness to them all. Awareness and kindness, kindfulness to the past. I mentioned that yesterday. And also kindfulness to the future. A good example of kindfulness to the future. What happens? What happens if Russia does send some nuclear bombs to Ukraine and Ukraine responds and the United States joins in and China joins in? Oh my goodness, it could be the end of the world. Were you excited? Afraid? Could happen, you know. Really, it won't, I guarantee that. But because of fear, number one, you can see how exciting fear is. When I say, no, it won't happen, you say, oh, you've got nothing to worry about. In other words, you have to be peaceful. It's amazing how people just are afraid because it's something to interest them. They don't know anything else to interest them. So after a while, we just decide not to be afraid of the future, though we can let go, forgive the whole of the past, everything. Don't judge anybody, just forgive everybody. Or at least make an open verdict. You don't know who's guilty and who's not guilty. Why the person did that, I'm not sure. Did they really do that? Were they just given all the full information? Did they misunderstand something? So don't need to judge anybody. You're so free. That's also why that saying, which is now on T-shirts, and I don't know if people really understand what it means, but that's that quote, no need to seek for revenge, because karma will get the bastards anyway. That's a naughty word, bastards, but it's not as naughty in Australia as it is in other countries. Sometimes you have an old friend, and you say, how you doing, my old bastard? And they don't mean anything negative by that at all. It's like a term of endearment. Like in UK, when I was a kid, they used to say, how are you going, old fruit? You call me an old fruit? That's a nice word. But anyway, so you don't have to worry about seeking revenge or getting angry. Karma will work it all out, whichever way it does. And you can be free. Imagine freedom. Freedom from the past. Freedom from the future. You're just here. You've gone into another layer of petals. Ordinary time has opened out and you're in the present moment, which is far more beautiful. You've done that through the combination of kindness and awareness. And then once you get into the present moment, now what do? Nothing. You don't do anything. You just enjoy it. Enjoy the beauty of just the present moment. Nothing to do, no work, no work to complete, nothing which you have to get done. It's one of the problems with you go on a meditation retreat, and many of you have to sacrifice a lot to get here. The money, airfares, taking time off work, you're asking permission from your husband, your wife, your kids, or whatever it is. And of course, you know that when you go back, they'll ask you, how did you do? And you feel a total nincompoop. If you say, well, nothing. What did you go away for? I could have used you. We had to clean out the shed. We had to look after the kids. You wasted your time. So you find that you feel, especially towards the last days of the retreat, you better get something. Otherwise you'll feel a real fool. Don't buy into that at all. Enjoy this lovely present moment where you're free. And so what happens next? The present moment, layer of petals, you just kindfulness to it. You're kind to it, enjoying it. Okay, present moment. If you want to do it this way or that way, it's up to you. My job is just to be aware of you and be this beautiful caring for you. Whatever you do, I approve of you. And after a while, that present moment opens up. And inside of that, silence. You've got nothing to think about. You don't have to think. There's beautiful silence. You never did that. You never said, I'll now be silent. It just comes to you. The time opens out, present moment opens out, and you're in the silence. It's natural. Because you never did it, you're never holding it, it's just there. Natural, easy, just like the water in the cup. It just happens. And then when you're in the silence, now what do I do? Nothing. Just be aware and be kind to the silence. It's very easy to be kind to silence, to care for it, because the deeper you go into these layers of petals in your lotus, which is you, of course, the deeper you go into those, the more beautiful it is. It's beautiful, the silence. But one thing, you get hindrances, and one of those hindrances comes like fear. It's so wonderful, so beautiful, you want to hold on to it. Please don't get lost in that. People tell me, like relationships, you find this beautiful partner, and just having a wonderful time together, and one of you just, you know, just, this is so important for them, they hold on to it too much. They grasp it. And the other person feels always being controlled all the time. And because of that, it breaks up the relationship. Please relax. You have a relationship now with the silence. You don't need to hold it. The more you try and hold it and grasp it and keep it, the more likely it is you're going to disturb it. So just relax. That's a kindness. Silence, if you want to go, that's fine by me. Then the silence will stay there. And then, of course, after the silence, that's a layer of petals, and that opens out. And really, what's inside there, well, I kept on doing this, it kind of surprised me, and then after a while, you realize why. The next layer of petals which comes up, is your breathing. Not like the breathing you say, I'm now going to watch my in-breath, watch my out-breath. It's just this very light, beautiful, easy to watch breath. It just comes in, and then when it finishes, it stops, and you see the gap between your breaths, and then the out-breath comes up. It's automatic. You're not doing it. You're just watching it with this beautiful smile on your face. You're kind. And the reason this happens is because at this point, nothing else is moving. Okay, you can watch your heart at this place, but if that happens, that's a time when I would say do something. Just put, if ever you feel that, some meditators do have that problem. They're watching the breath, but they can become aware of their heartbeat. And sometimes it's because of a bit extra excitement. They realize something's happening, I'm getting close to some nice meditation. Boom, 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 boom. So if that ever happens, if you try and push that heartbeat away, you're giving it importance. It's like not being kind to the anger-eating monster. And because you're trying to push it away, it gets stronger. The trick is that if you have, say, a heartbeat and you have the breath in these stages of meditation, just imagine a screen and your breath is in the middle of the screen. The heartbeat's on the edge of the screen. You don't push it away, you include it, but not in the center. The central vision, the central object is the breathing. You can feel on the edge of the screen of awareness is the heartbeat. So you're aware of two objects at the time, but because the central object is your breathing, that will soon dominate and the experience of your heartbeat will fall off the edge of the screen. You just have the breath there, that's all. The same way if whenever you're meditating, if you have an ache or a pain or an ant on you or something, or mosquito, don't put the mosquito in the center of your screen. Keep it on the edge. Keep the other objects in the center. And then that mosquito or ant or something, it kind of falls off the screen as you focus in. So anyway, you've got this beauty of the breath going in and going out. The reason is, again, it's the last thing which is moving on your body. And then you have the ordinary breath, just seeing it come in, go out, come in, go out. And then, of course, what happens? That opens out and you get the delightful breath. The breath is, it's not just beautiful, the whole thing is gorgeous. And I say this because this is what happens. When you get that delightful breath going in and going out, that's when it gets very, very powerful. And I mentioned, I think before, I call that the pivot point of meditation. Once you get to that, the rest is really easy. You're enjoying it, really enjoying it. This is fun. This is satisfying. And the wandering mind doesn't have a chance anymore. Because you're with this delightful breath. The only obstacle which you have to be careful of, again, is fear. Because you realize you're losing control. And when you say that word, losing control, does that bring fear to you? It's wonderful to lose control, because when you control it, you always mess it up. When you just let go and be still, then things go very wonderfully well. And so you find out, okay, I can lose control for a while. You're not in control anyway, are you? Be honest with yourself. All the things you try to control, what's happened? It's much better just to sit down and watch and enjoy.
Let it be, let it go.
So then you're just watching this delightful breath, breathing in, breathing out. And when you watch that for long enough, just with kindfulness, ah, well done, mind. But you don't ask it for anything else, this will do me. Then you go to the next stage of the meditation. The delightful breath opens out, the perception of breath disappears, the delight stays. You start to see these beautiful lights in the mind. This is where the nimitta stage happens. It's like you see the delightful breath, when that opens up, inside is this gorgeous lights, nimittas. And I say they're gorgeous because they are. And they're weird, lovely weird, wonderfully weird. This is where you start to experience some of the spiritual highs, which some people talk about. And this is not just this is not just for monks and nuns. This is for you, anybody. You don't have to be, I suppose, mentally normal, if such a thing ever exists. You're just an ordinary person. You may be deformed, you may be old, you may be schizophrenic, you may be Down syndrome, I don't know. It doesn't matter, because this is to do with the mind, not with the brain. And so you see these beautiful lights in the mind. Once you see these beautiful lights, a really important thing about those lights is that the colour is different from ordinary colours. It's actually not seeing a light, it's a mental image which you perceive as a light. It's the closest thing in your repertoire of experience. That's why you give it the name light. It's not a light, but that's how it appears. And a good example of that, I think I'm the only one who's had this nimitta in existence. The Buddha never had a nimitta like this. I think, Ronnie, you know what I'm going to say now, don't you? Because I was meditating a few range retreats ago, and I got this, you know, getting nice and peaceful, nice delightful breath, and that just vanished, and this nimitta came up. And it's yellow. And this yellow nimitta, it's not the ordinary yellow, it's like, you know, the little teddy bear over there. It was much deeper than that, richer, pure yellow, more yellow than any yellow you'll ever see. And then I noticed its shape. It wasn't just, you know, a nice disc. It had a form to it. And when I was aware of the form, I recognized the form straight away. That was the form of Garfield, the cat in the cartoons. That's why I said I think I'm the only person ever to have a Garfield nimitta. It was a nimitta, the colors proved that. But the trouble was I reacted, I laughed. You know my character. I've been reading too many Garfield comics in the newspapers or whatever, I'm not sure. But then, that was the end of that meditation. But it was good, good fun. So anyway, that's what happens. You see these beautiful lights in there. And then you say, oh, well, I've got a nimitta. Now what do I do? Oh, no. Enjoy. You get lots of happiness. Energizes you. You feel great. You got something to tell your husband, your wife about when you go home. Yeah, I got a nimitta. Really? Wow, well done. I'm not that so much. It's just, you know, something's happening. And then when you've got this beautiful nimitta, then what do? Just kindfulness. Leave it alone. Just be aware and have a beautiful care. Oh, thank you for coming. And then what happens? You feel yourself going inside the nimitta. The flower petals is opening up. It's a beautiful petal already, nimitta petal. And it opens up, you see what's inside of it. You go inside of it. And that is the first jhana. And that is beautiful. It's got a happiness to it that you haven't experienced before. Very still, I won't say too much about it. Because, you know, that will take away your joy of experiencing those things. And if a person does achieve one of those, you come and tell me during one of the interview sessions. And a lot of time I say, no, that wasn't a nimitta. No, you know, you're just imagining it. No, like, girls can't get nimittas. When I say that, I don't mean it, I'm just testing you. I look at your eyes and see if I can see some anger. See some, what do you mean, Ajahn Brahm? Girls can't get nimittas, that's not fair. Of course you can. You do that, because if you just had a nimitta, you can't get upset. No way you can get any anger or disappointment, no matter what happens. I'm just testing you. It's a little trick of the trade to see actually who has really got these jhanas and who hasn't. So anyway, then you get a beautiful jhana. Look, quite frankly, if you get one of those in this retreat, wow, well done. And that will change your life just that much. There's this, I love telling this story again. And there's one of these retreats about 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, I forget how long. This guy came, and each one of you, you know, you're reasonably well dressed, or maybe it's because it's winter time. But this was during that one of the, I think the Easter retreats in April, May. And this guy came in, I just happened to be around the reception area. So I asked, I looked at him, he was wearing what I call traditional Australian national dress. I think you understand what that means. Thongs, shorts, singlet. I forget what he had on top of the singlet. And you could see all his tattoos and big bushy hair and beard. A big guy. And it was totally just like he was going to the building site, not coming on a retreat. And I do mistakes. I don't mind admitting my stupid mistakes often. And I said to him, I judged him straight away. And I said, excuse me, sir, I think you've got the wrong place. If you're visiting your friends at Carnet, it's 6 kilometres up the road. You've got the wrong place. That's what he looked like. And I judged by appearances, so I should never do that. And he said, no, I'm on a retreat. And he saw his name there, he booked in. So, OK, sorry, I apologise. And he had the last laugh, or we call it the last laugh, because he came on one of the interviews I gave him, and he started describing what his meditation was. And I was just bowled over. I said, that was a jhana. He was the last person, everybody on the retreat I ever thought would even get close to a jhana. And he actually really got one. And then he kind of disappeared. I tracked him down later on. He went over to the Sydney area somewhere. And, you know, he says that changed his whole life, just those experiences. You know, really seeing the Dhamma. And I say why it changes your life. I love saying this, because if ever you look in the suttas, these are just, you know, the gold standard of Dhamma. And in those suttas, the Buddha described what it feels like to be in a first jhana. And he said one of the definitions or descriptions was, he called it sambodhisukha. The pleasure you feel is called sambodhisukha. If there's anybody who knows any bit about Pali, sambodhi means enlightenment. He said this is enlightenment happiness. It's not enlightenment, we all know that, but it's close enough. The Buddha himself. So I want to describe how it feels. It feels like enlightenment. Wow. Now, you want, people love experiences. Unfortunately, our modern generation likes knowledge more than experience. They want to have words to describe these things. That's why they read books and listen to talks of mine and other good monks and good nuns. But this is what he said it feels like. Wow. So if you have a first jhana experience, you understand what enlightenment is like. And that's your personal experience. That's what you know, you feel. And of course, that's so much more powerful than any words by the best
scholar, because you've experienced it, you felt it, it's like you've been there. So that's why these things are incredibly powerful. And also, then there are other jhanas, they lie right in the center of the first jhana. Inside the first jhana, those layer petals opens up and you get into the second jhana. Those petals open up and you get into the third jhana. And even the first jhana, you think, there can't be more happiness than this. Yeah, there is. And it just blows you away just how much bliss and peace and emptiness and freedom there is. That's why this path is just really, really good fun. Really interesting. It's powerful. It's majestic. And that's why when people say you spend a whole 9 days watching your breath, how boring can that be? So you haven't got a clue what you're talking about. This is fantastic. One of the other things I love saying is every now and again, how many of you have been on pilgrimage to India, the holy sites? How many of you have visited the four holy sites? No, you haven't. What are the four holy sites? Vicky, you should know better. Please don't answer a question which I say. It's always a trick question somewhere. The four holy sites of Buddha, where the Buddha hang out. That's where his body lived. Where does his mind hang out? The four holy sites. First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. You don't need a visa or an airline ticket to go there. You just need to come to Jhana Grove. And if you really get into it, because what you're doing, you're experiencing how the Buddha felt, how they lived in incredibly powerful states. And afterwards, the benefits, I'll talk more about those later on. But this is, the next stage is always right inside where you are now, so don't go anywhere. Don't do anything, don't disturb the process. The process is happening, the sun's in the sky, it's warm, you see the light, that lotus will open up. Of course it will open up, it has to open up. It's nature, it's nothing to do with you. It's just nature. So you just sit down and enjoy the journey. It'll blow your mind. That's what it's supposed to do. You know, the time of your life. That guy who came in Australian national dress, you know, he never expected this to happen to him, but it did, and it changed his whole life. So if you want to do the same old life, you better get out now. If you want to have some fun, some joy, some incredible stuff, stay here. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, we do have some interviews now, but please keep the interview questions to meditation. Please don't ask about your family, because I haven't got a family. I've never had kids. I've never got married. Please don't ask about your work, because I do work, but different type of work. Please. So keep it to the meditation, and keep it to 10 minutes. There's always full schedules, so just 10 minutes each. So if it's at 10 minutes and you're still talking, I'll get the gong. Oh, well, strike the gong. I won't strike you. I can't do that. Okay, have a nice morning, those of you who aren't on the interviews.